This morning when I went out to walk my dog at about 6:15 in the morning, a robin greeted me at in the dogwood tree by my front door. And since then, maybe that's the robin. Since then I arrived at church and a lot more of the daffodils are open. And it feels like the earth is awake again. And as I was writing out, I'd been holding for several weeks for opening words or whatever, the words from the Book of Solomon that just sing to me this time of year. For now the winter is past, the rain is over and gone, and the flowers appear on the earth, and the time for singing has come. I have a story for you this morning. It starts like all good stories start, and how's that? Once upon a time. Once upon a time, there was a rather average king who ruled a rather small kingdom. And that kingdom didn't have many resources. But the kingdom did have one very, very valuable thing. It was a huge, perfect diamond, a flawless diamond. It was kept on display in the royal treasury. And people would come from far and wide to see how perfect and beautiful it was. And guards would stand by it, always keeping a watch over it. One day, one of the guards came running to the king in a panic. And he said, "King, you won't believe this. No one's been near the diamond, but the huge crack in it." So the king went running himself to see, and sure enough, there it was, an awful crack right through the middle of the diamond. So he summoned all the jewelers in the land to come and take a look at that diamond. And one after the other, they gave him the bad news. It's ruined. It's a major flaw. It's irredeemably flawless. It's useless as a precious stone. The king and the people of his land were crushed, for it was their perfect thing. Then one day, out of nowhere, came an old woman. She asked if she could see the diamond. The king figured, what's there to lose? So he let her take a look at the flawed diamond. And she looked, and she studied it, and she said to the king, "I can fix it. In fact, I can make it even better than it was before." Well, the king was rather suspicious. And then she said, "You let me take it for a week, and I will do it." And the king said, "Well, you know, it may not be worth much, but I'm not going to let it out of the palace." But he did see something in the old lady that he trusted. So instead, he set her up in a special room in the palace, with all the tools she needed, and provided her with a place to sleep and with food and drink, whatever she needed. And then after a week, she returned to the king, and she handed him the diamond. Well, he had been waiting in great anticipation. But when he saw the diamond that she handed to her, he couldn't believe his eyes. It was magnificent. The old woman had fixed it. No, she had made it into something even better than it was before. You see, she used that crack that was running down the diamond as a stem, and she carved a beautiful rose on the top, and those little flaws became leaves and little thorns on the stem. So the king said to her that he was overjoyed, and he offered to give her half the kingdom. For she had improved on something that was perfect. But the old lady said no, she had not done that. Instead, she had taken something that was flawed and cracked, something with great imperfection, and from that had created something new and beautiful. It's one of my favorite stories. And I think what I'd like to do for all of those going to RE is just suggest to you that maybe Now that you've heard that story, maybe you talk about it with your friends or with your family or maybe an RE.
Just think what that might mean to you.
This morning I'd like to share with you thoughts from two very insightful women on this theme of perfectionism. First, Kathleen Norris. Perfectionism is one of the scariest words I know. It's a marked characteristic of a contemporary American culture, a serious psychological affliction that makes people too timid to take necessary risk and causes them to suffer when, although they have done the best they can, their efforts fall short of some imaginary and usually unattainable standard. Internally, it functions as a form of myopia, a preoccupation with self-image that can stunt emotional growth. The second is from Dr. Rachel Naomi Remen. Wholeness lies beyond perfection. Perfection is only an idea. For most experts, and many of the rest of us, it has become a life goal. The pursuit of perfection may actually be dangerous to your health. The type A personality for whom perfectionism is a way of life is associated with heart disease. Perfectionism can break your heart and all the hearts around you. A perfectionist sees life as if it were one of those little pictures that used to appear in newspapers over the caption, "What's wrong with this picture?" You look at the picture carefully, and you'd see that the table only had three legs, or the house had no door. I remember the aha that these pictures would evoke in me as a child. I wonder now why anyone would want to take such satisfaction in seeing what's missing, what's wrong, what is broken. The pursuit of perfection has been a major addiction of our time. Fortunately, perfectionism is learned. No one is born a perfectionist, which is why it's possible to recover. I'm a recovering perfectionist. Before I began recovering, I experienced that I and everyone else was always falling short, that who we were and what we did was never quite good enough. I sat in judgment on life itself. Perfectionism is the belief that life is broken. Sometimes perfectionists have had a parent who was a perfectionist, someone who awarded approval on the basis of performance and achievement. Children can learn early that they are loved for what they do and not simply for who they are. To a perfectionist parent, what you do never seems as good as what you might do if you tried just a little harder. The life of such children can be a constant striving to earn love. Of course, love is never earned. It is a grace we give to one another. Anything we need to earn is only approval. The pursuit of perfection is built into every professional training. But long before I went to medical school, I was trained as a perfectionist by my father. As a child, when I brought home a 98 on an exam, he invariably responded, "What happened to the other 2 points?" I adored my dad, and my whole childhood was focusing on the pursuit of the other 2 points. By the time I was in my 20s, I had become as much of a perfectionist as he. It was no longer necessary for him to ask me about the 2 points. I'd taken that over for myself. It was many years before I found out that those points don't matter, that they are not the secret to living a life worth remembering, that they don't make you lovable or whole.
The birds, they sang at the break of day. "Start again," I heard them say. "Don't dwell on what has passed away or what is yet to be. Yeah, the wars, they will be fought again. The holy dove, she will be caught again. Bought and sold and bought again, the dove is never free. Ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. Ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. That's how the light gets in. That's how the light gets in. That's how the light gets in.
I want to begin my sermon by going back to this morning's message for all ages, the King and the Diamond. You know, sometimes we use that expression, a message for all ages, to mean a children's story. But I believe this morning's story is truly one that does have a message for all ages. Perhaps it has a message that is even more important for adults than children. I actually find it to be a rather profound story. It reminds me of how much value we place on things in our life being perfect. And when we discover the cracks like the king did in the diamond, we become upset, angry, depressed, and in the extreme, we too sometimes even feel as they did in that kingdom, that all was over. For many of us, our perfectionist tendencies become the obstacles preventing us from moving forward and seeing new possibilities in the way that things are. In the words of Kathleen Norris, perfectionism functions as a form of myopia, a preoccupation with self-image that can stunt emotional growth. Now, I know I'm not the only type A person in this room who has a streak of perfectionism in him. Like Dr. Remen, I got the idea that I needed to be perfect, to be the best and nothing less, and to expect the same from others at an early age. You remember in the reading I shared with you, she tells us that perfectionism is something that we learn, and she learned it from her father, and to some extent I probably did from mine. My father is a wonderful man, but he is one of those people who finds fault with everything you do. But I think there is more to this tendency towards perfectionism that some of us have than just the behavior we learn from living up to our parents' expectations. Perfectionism in some part of your life can also be a way of compensating for some other part of your life where you may feel inadequate. It took me a long time to accept the fact that I, like other gay men of my age, suffer from what has come to be known as the best little boy in the world syndrome. The idea that we have to be better than the next person in what we do so that being gay wouldn't be held against us. And I know many professional women in the professions and the business world who've had a similar experience of driving towards perfectionism as a way of compensating for being female. There is a sense that if you are so good in some way, then your boss or your neighbors or even your family have to accept you, even if they have a negative view of some other part of your life. Now, it's not all bad, and sometimes true greatness emerges from that kind of a struggle. Many of you know that until a few years ago, Malcolm and I shared our home with a famous elder concert pianist, Uncle T. He grew up gay at a time when the world wasn't even using the word, and he was severely ostracized and discriminated against at one point in his life. And it was then he threw himself into his piano studies, and he became a great concert pianist, winning the Nomburg Award in 1940. And he often said, "I had to play perfectly so they would not hold who I was against me." He had to be so good that that was all that mattered. There are certainly many other stories of greatness that follow this kind of path, but it also can be a course that is unhealthy and destructive in our lives and in the lives of those around us. It's great to be motivated to do a good job, and I'm certainly not preaching a sermon to encourage a sloppy and irresponsible way of life or the failure to live up to one's potential, but rather to suggest that we be a little easier on ourselves and on the others around us. Striving for perfection can really hold us back from so many things. The perfectionist's unending focus on what is wrong can cause us to overlook what is so wonderful in our lives. We can get really stuck in our perfectionism. It can preclude us from creatively moving on to the next chapter in our lives. I have a good friend who is a well-known Provincetown painter and who has a heavy dose of perfectionist tendencies. She'd admit that. A few years ago, she traveled to the area where she grew up, and she found her favorite tree as a child still standing in the middle of a field. She got out the canvas and paints and began to work. She took photographs so she could use them to finish the painting in her studio. When she returned home, she worked on that painting for months, redoing branches, changing the way the light cast the shadow. She even sanded the painting to try and change the effect. She didn't want to show it to anyone because it was not finished. She had not yet got it right. She was still fixing it. I did see the painting in several different incarnations, and they were all beautiful. But to her, it was not right. She would spend entire days on that painting, and she was unable to move on to another. Her perfectionism, her desire to have this tree exactly right, held her from moving on and crippled her creativity for a period of time. The author Julia Cameron writes, "Perfectionism has nothing to do with getting it right. It has nothing to do with fixing things. It has nothing to do with standards. Perfectionism is the refusal to let yourself move ahead. It is a loop, an obsessive, debilitating closed system that causes you to get stuck in the details of what you are writing or painting or making and to lose sight of the whole. Instead of creating freely and allowing errors to reveal themselves later as insights, we often get mired in getting the details right. We correct our originality into uniformity that lacks passion and spontaneity." I have to say that I find those words rather stinging comments and perhaps even a bit overstated, but I get the point. It hits home. What I often have to remind myself, and what my artist friend could not grasp, was expressed by Paul Gardner this way: a painting is never finished. It simply stops at an interesting place. It's not just a painting that we can feel that way about. A business proposal, a book you are writing, a speech, a sermon, even something like decorating your house, all are never finished for perfectionists. There's always one more thing you could tweak. You know, every week I have the feeling that if I had more time, the sermon could be better. There are still words to change, ideas to develop. I could skip dinner with Malcolm and keep working, or I could not make that pastoral call I wanted to make and keep working, or I could let go and accept the fact that it was good or at least okay and call it done. It's not an easy thing for someone with perfectionist tendencies to do that, but it's so necessary. At some point, we need to say to ourselves, what else would I be doing if I didn't feel I had to do this thing perfectly? As Dr. Remen pointed out, our drive to perfectionism can isolate us from so many other important things in our life. I'm not suggesting we should be lazy or not strive for high standards in our work, but there's a time to stop and say, what I've done is good. The late Unitarian Universalist minister Peter Fleck suggested that there's some theological precedent for being happy with less than perfection. In the Genesis story of the seven-day creation, at the end of each day, God inspects his work and pronounces that it is good. Interestingly, you would have thought God to proclaim it perfect. But no, it's just good. Now, I went back and read the story again, and my first reaction was, wow, a report card full of B's. You mean God didn't get any A's for these creations? Why was each of the aspects of creation just good? Well, Peter Fleck suggests that it's because creation is not complete. There's more to come. If it were perfect, there would be no need for human creativity. If it were perfect, it would be over. It seems to me that God in the Genesis story is saying that creation is good enough for the moment. For a real perfectionist, very little ever lives up to their standards. Have you ever heard about a person or a place and developed such an image or an expectation that when you finally meet this person or visit this place, which you thought would be perfectly wonderful, you were disappointed because it didn't match your idea? When I was buying a home, I would have this experience. I would review the real estate listing in great detail and apply my vision of the perfect home. I would see the entire home in my head. When I got to the house, I was always disappointed. Plato had something to say about this. He taught his students that only the idea of something is perfect, and its realization, its expression in material worldly terms, a mere shadow of that perfectionism. We know this, yet it's easy to get caught up in the expectation of perfection. Dr. Remen tells us that perfection is not good for your health. She tells us that it can literally break your heart, but it can also break the hearts of those around us. We know that our drive towards perfection can take us away from our interactions with families and friends because we don't have time. But there's also another way our perfectionism can hurt those around us. Perfectionists tend to live their lives looking for what's wrong and trying to fix it. Do you always see what's wrong in your spouse or your partner or your friend or your children? Is that how you approach them? Sure, kids need to be told when they're doing something wrong, and a well-intended suggestion to a partner or a friend can be useful, but this is not a way to affirm a relationship. So we need to let go of our perfectionism a bit, but we need to do more than that. We also need to embrace our errors, our imperfections. The poet William Stafford wrote, "Your exact errors make music. Your straying feet find the great dance. And you live on a world where stumbling always leads home." By embracing our imperfections, our creativity continues to flow. Our errors may just be the route to the new chapter in our life. You know, even from the world of science, we can learn the importance of imperfection. There's a quote on your order of service, but I'm going to read it to you. Lewis Thomas wrote, "We have evolved scientists, and so we know a lot about DNA. But if our kind of mind had been confronted with the problem of designing a similar replicating molecule, we would never have succeeded. We would have made one fatal mistake. Our molecule would have been perfect. The capacity to blunder slightly is the real marvel of DNA. Without this special attribute, we would still be anaerobic bacteria, and there would be no music." The idea of the importance of imperfection really comes to us from many traditions. And there's a Buddhist story that I like. It tells of an elderly Chinese woman who had two large pots. Each hung on the end of a pole which she carried across her neck and shoulders to bring water home. One of the pots had a crack in it, while the other pot was perfect and always delivered its full portion of water. After the end of the long walk from the stream to her house, the crack pot arrived only half full. Of course, the perfect pot was proud of its accomplishments, but the poor cracked pot was ashamed of its imperfection. It spoke to the woman one day by the stream, saying, "I'm ashamed of myself because this crack in my side causes water to leak out all the way back to your house." And the old woman smiled and said, "Did you notice that there are flowers on your side of the path, but none on the other pot's side?" As Leonard Cohen wrote in the song that Mike and Songhee beautifully performed, "Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. The imperfections in our lives are where the light comes in." Are you catching the light that comes into your life through your imperfections? Or are you too caught up in getting it right to allow that to happen? There are blessings to be found in imperfections. The trick is to allow ourselves to receive those blessings, to let your errors make music, and to trust, as the poet said, that indeed stumbling always leads home. For our benediction, I'd like to go back to two of the sources we heard from in our service. The first words from the poet William Stafford: "Your exact errors make a music that nobody hears. Your straying feet find the great dance walking alone. And you live in a world where stumbling always leads home." And Leonard Cohen: "Ring the bell that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. That's how the light gets in." Go in peace, and now join in singing to each other a benediction printed in your order of service.